It's Wednesday, December the 15th, and you're very welcome to the Inside Politics podcast from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. In a moment, I'll be joined by our London correspondent, Dennis Staunton, and later on in the podcast, I'll be talking to Irish Times columnist, Newton Emerson. But first, Christmas is coming, and that means that we're going to be recording one of our Ask Me Anything shows for next week with the Irish Times political staff. And if you have any questions for the team, please do send them in to us by this Saturday, December the 18th. All the questions will be considered for broadcast, subject to the usual rules of taste and decency, of course. And you can mail your questions to politicspodcast@irishtimes.com. That's politicspodcast@irishtimes.com by Saturday the 18th. We are especially receptive to questions submitted as a sound file so that we can add your own dulcet tones to the squawking, honking and whinnying that you usually get here every week. Although that is obviously not the case when the always mellifluous Dennis Staunton is on the line from London. Hello, Dennis.
Hi, Hugh.
You are preparing to go in and observe the goings-on in the House of Commons. Plenty of goings-on there at the moment. A really embarrassing rebellion from Tory backbench MPs last night.
Yeah, it was a big defeat for Boris Johnson in terms of his internal party numbers. But obviously, because Labour supported these measures, it was about new measures to combat coronavirus. And they're pretty mild by Irish standards, but nonetheless, they were all too much for about 100 Conservative MPs, and particularly this idea that you would bring in some kind of COVID certification to get into a nightclub or a venue with more than 500 people if you can move around in it, or for very big venues. And so around about 100 Conservative MPs voted against the government on this. And it was particularly embarrassing because just less than an hour before they voted, Boris Johnson had been talking to them in the 1922 committee, which is the backbenchers group, and pleading with them to support the government, saying this was the responsible thing to do, that he was doing this so that he wouldn't have to bring in tougher restrictions afterwards. And effectively what they said to him was, we don't trust you. And so they went and they voted for this. And it puts him in a very difficult position because these measures are pretty mild. It looks like the Omicron variant is just about to overwhelm us all here in London especially. And there's a good chance that in the next few weeks he's going to have to bring in tougher measures. And the question is, where does he stand with his own party when he tries to do that?
And as you say, they are by Irish standards quite mild. Why the very, very strong resistance to these in the UK? It seems to be a very different mindset there.
I think it's partly that there is this very strong libertarian element on the backbenches. And so they resist anything that looks like an infringement of personal liberty to them. I think another part of the problem, though, is the way in which Boris Johnson has handled both his MPs and this issue. So, for example, last week when he was facing all these embarrassing questions about parties that had gone on in Downing Street a year ago, which seemed to have broken the lockdown, he appeared to bring forward various announcements about the coronavirus and about what he was going to have to do about it. And this looked cynical to his MPs, some of whom said, you're asking us to vote on these things, but you actually haven't waited for the evidence to show, for example, exactly how this variant is behaving. Is it really as dangerous as you say? What's the actual threat to the hospitals? And also whether any of these measures actually work. You know, you've had vaccine passports in Scotland for a while and still there, having the same kind of level of infections as we are everywhere else. And so part of it is really to do with the measures and this kind of libertarian streak. But another part of it, I mean, if you look at the people who voted against the government, they came from all the wings of the party. There were people, there were red wall people who just won their seats in 2019. There were old loyalists of Theresa May. She abstained on the vote herself. There were people from every area. There were old Brexiteers. There were Remainer types. There were all kinds of people, which had in common the fact they're all fed up with Boris Johnson. And in some ways, they're fed up for different reasons. And some of them appear to have been sending a signal to Boris Johnson, you need to get your act together. You need to sort out Downing Street. Your Downing Street operation is crazy. It's chaotic. It's filled with courtiers who are afraid to tell you the truth. And you need to kind of get a better operation.
And what are the chances of him doing that? He really has had, over the last, what, 3, 4, 5, 6 weeks, since the mess over the Owen Paterson resignation, through to these ongoing stories about the behaviour of Downing Street staff over the course of last Christmas and them breaking regulations, and that's been leaking out, continuing to drip out photographs of parties and various other types of things. What are the chances, do you think, that he can actually get a grip? Is this not the Boris Johnson style that we're seeing here?
It is the Boris Johnson style, although there are a few styles that Boris Johnson has in his repertoire. And so, for example, until about a year ago, Downing Street was run by Dominic Cummings in a reign of terror. And everybody was afraid of Dominic Cummings, including the Prime Minister himself, it seemed. And so you had this authoritarian approach to governing, ignoring the rules when it suited him, but at the same time imposing this absolutely brutal discipline on MPs who felt they were treated with absolute contempt, as indeed they were, but they were afraid really to resist. And then once Cummings and his Vote Leave gang were thrown out the door, then there was great rejoicing among MPs, and a more civilized regime appeared to get in there. But then there'd been all these whispers about people who are too close to Boris Johnson's wife, Carrie, former acolytes of Michael Gove, that this group of people are in there, and that, you know, that it's gone from a position where the Prime Minister's voice didn't matter at all because Cummings was making all the decisions, to the Prime Minister's view being the only view that matters, and nobody being there to say, actually, you need to do something that you don't feel comfortable doing, and nobody having the authority within Downing Street to do that. So one way, obviously, that he can do something about that is to fire a few people, which he'll probably get an opportunity to do when the cabinet secretary reports into these parties that happened. So there'll be an opportunity for a bit of a reshuffle. And then the question is, can he get in somebody that he trusts and who is can get a grip on the Downing Street operation, say, to act as chief of staff? And there have been a number of names floating around, but every time a name pops up, the name themselves make clear they're not going to have anything to do with it. And so I think that in a funny way, I mean, I think there's going to be a bit more bad news to come. There's a chance that a by-election in North Shropshire, which they won in 2019 with nearly 23,000 seat vote majority, that could actually be lost. Now, even if they cling on to that by a few hundred votes, obviously it'll be a bad result, but they'd take that, thank you very much, as being something like a victory. But if they lose that, that's obviously going to be, there will be further questions. And then the question is, I think, though, what happens with the pandemic itself? So could it be that actually the pandemic, the Omicron variant moves so fast that public opinion moves ahead of the Conservative Party, and that the people suddenly realise that they're at risk and they want more restrictions? And that's how it has gone in the past with this pandemic, that actually the public have embraced restrictions. And so, for example, when Downing Street would do a focus group, at the height of it all, saying, we're thinking of introducing a curfew for 10 o'clock. What do you think? The focus groups would say, why not make it 9? And so they always wanted a little bit more. And so there's a chance that Boris Johnson, strangely enough, could find himself in the next few weeks, if he does defy those backbenchers, and if he goes with the benefit of Labour votes to move ahead, he could actually find himself closer to public opinion. And that could mean that there's a softening in the rebellion, because it suddenly, instead of looking rather brave to be opposing these restrictions, it would start to look foolish. So there is a chance that those circumstances will change things for him. But at the same time, I think he does need to get to do something to get a grip on the Downing Street operation, because these mutinous noises coming from his MPs have suddenly become serious. They've started to talk about his actual future.
Well, indeed. And on that, I mean, you've been very consistent throughout your analysis of this particular government in describing the transactional nature of the relationship between the Conservative Parliamentary Party and Boris Johnson. He's there because he won them an election and they believe he can do so possibly in the future. Once that belief begins to waver, his position begins to become unstable, because there are no real Johnsonites. There is no Johnson wing as such in the Conservative Party. In a way, this is always true of the Conservative Party. It's notoriously cold-blooded about these matters, isn't it? But listening to you there, I don't think you think, am I right, that there's going to be an attempted heave in the spring or before next summer or anything like that, unless some other catastrophe happens.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you're never too far from a potential catastrophe here at the moment. So you know, I certainly wouldn't bet against another catastrophe or an unforeseen scandal, something that we really had no idea about. I think, for example, if pictures were to emerge of these alleged gatherings in the Downing Street flat, hosted by the Prime Minister and his wife during lockdown. If that turns out to have been the case, that that those things happened, the Downing Street has denied they ever did. But if they did happen, and if there are pictures of them, I think that could make things a bit difficult. And I think it's all to do with the question of the Conservative Party's nerves, and the nerves are very fragile at the moment. I think one of the things that has kept Boris Johnson in place for so long is the idea that if people imagine themselves in a campaign, do they think that Boris Johnson is better placed to help them to hold their seat or not? And certainly in the Red Wall, a lot of those MPs would have thought that he was the connection with their voters, with Brexit. And a lot of those people who voted last night against the government are those people in the Red Wall seats, which suggests that they're wondering about that now. And so it could be that, particularly if the potential rivals, or rather their friends, start to build up a bit of a narrative about how Rishi Sunak would be a better bet going into the next election, or Liz Truss, or Jeremy Hunt, or whoever it happens to be, how you're better off with this, and you'd be more in tune with your voters. And also the other thing that's going to happen over the next few months is they're going to be watching the opinion polls. Labour has pulled ahead in the polls with its biggest poll lead over the Conservatives since 2014. Now, that polls can come and go, but if that sustains itself, and there's no question but that Keir Starmer's new front bench, it has some much better media performers than his previous crowd did. And so there's a chance that, there's more bad news for the government, more good news for Labour, more anxiety for the Conservative MPs, and that they just decide, well, actually, it's just better to lance this boil, and we need to get somebody new in there to have a reset by the middle of 2022 to prepare for an election probably the next year.
From an Irish perspective, I'm sure lots of people might wonder how, if at all, any of this fits in with the current UK government's position on the ongoing negotiations on the Northern Ireland Protocol with the European Union. The heat seems to have gone out of that particular process a little bit over the last few weeks. And indeed, there was another, I'm not sure if you describe it as a concession or a strategic withdrawal last week by the British government on the issue of the role of the European Court of Justice. Has the heat gone out of it, and might it ratchet up again, perhaps after Christmas?
I think, a lot of the heat has been deliberately withdrawn from it by both the British and the European side. And so you hear, although there are these ritual repetitions on the British side that Article 16 remains an option if the talks don't succeed. The fact is that, until a few weeks ago, they were always on the point of triggering Article 16. There's no mention of that anymore. There used to be a deadline of 3 weeks for the end of the talks, and that's, a couple of months ago. And so what's happening now is that Boris Johnson, or rather David Frost and Maros Shefcovic, will talk twice between now and Christmas. So it looks like there's a kind of a chance that we might get a deal on access to medicines for people in Northern Ireland. That's a particularly difficult and sensitive issue. And it involves a big concession on the European side in a way, because they have to actually change their own rules. And so it looks like we might get that by Christmas. And then afterwards, they'll go back in and try to get a deal on the other practical issues, like checks on goods and on animals and animal products going into Northern Ireland from Great Britain. What happened last week was that some European journalists based in London, including myself, we got a briefing from a senior UK official who said that Britain's demand that the European Court of Justice should be taken out of the protocol, that should no longer have a role in adjudicating the compliance with the protocol's rules, that should be gone, that demand was not going to derail the talks. So in other words, this person was saying, if these talks fail, it's not going to be because of that. We've agreed, and it's an important shift in our position. This person said we are going to just talk about the things that we both agree are necessary. We understand that the European Commission doesn't have a mandate to negotiate about the European Court of Justice. We think that in the long term, that no durable solution can really be found without dealing with these governance issues. But actually, we're for the purposes of these current talks, we're putting that to one side, the issue of governance. Now, Downing Street then, immediately after that, came down heavy and said this was mischaracterized their position, as they put it. But they then, the denial then just went on to say no durable solution is possible without dealing with all the issues, including the European Court of Justice. So in a way, it was a kind of an on-denial denial, or certainly it allowed, it left open the interpretation that we still maintain that the European Court of Justice should be gone, but we're prepared to do a deal without it. Now, obviously, if they do a deal in the new year on those practical matters, even if they think they can come back later and try to get something on the European Court of Justice, they're deluding themselves, because once you've done a deal on the practical issues, where's your moral authority to say, like, at the moment, the only moral authority they have is this claim that the protocol is messing up life in Northern Ireland. Well, if it's not, what do you do?
And just finally, what's your read on that move? Because there was outrage, I think it's fair to say, in Dublin and possibly in Brussels as well, when this was thrown on the table as being one of the sort of the red lines or the deal breakers a while ago, given, as you say, the negotiations were supposed to be about addressing the actual practical problems on the ground in Northern Ireland and the political difficulties they were causing in Northern Ireland. And nobody, it seemed to me, in Northern Ireland was really giving out about the role of the European Court of Justice. So why this move now? I mean, it looks positive in terms of a willingness to do a deal that didn't necessarily seem to be there a month or two ago.
I think that the British thinking has developed. I mean, I think that one of the things that happened was that if they had triggered Article 16 a few months ago, say in the summer or even early autumn, I think it might have been quite effective for them in terms of resetting the negotiations. They left it too late. And because they left it too late, the cost of doing it became too great, because the Europeans made clear that they would retaliate in the most brutal fashion, like by terminating the trade agreement. And so suddenly the cost of it became too much. And that meant that it couldn't perform its function within the negotiations to just kind of twist the lever so that the temperature would go a little bit higher in the negotiations to Britain's advantage. So Article 16 no longer was serving its purpose. And then there was a question of, what do you do? Do you, keep the negotiations going forever and leave this as a kind of a frozen conflict? Or do you actually blow them up with Article 16? Or do you actually try to do a deal? And so it looks like, from what we heard last week, at least from the senior official, that at least part of the government thinks it's time to start doing a deal. Now, I know that within the cabinet there is some disagreement on this. Nobody quite knows Boris Johnson's mind, but certainly where David Frost would be something of a hardliner, there are others, for example, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Rishi Sunak, who would be, and indeed Michael Gove, who used to be involved in the negotiations, who would actually say, look, let's sort this out. This is, we have such bigger things to deal with in terms of our relationship with Europe, and also more trouble coming down the track economically, potentially over the next year, that we don't need this extra potential problem with the threat that it entails to our economic future. So I think that, I think the mood in government has shifted over the last while, and I think we may be seeing a mood towards trying to get this resolved early in the new year. Which doesn't mean that they will, because in all these negotiations, things can go wrong very quickly.
Dennis, thanks very much indeed for joining us. Stick with us. Newton Emerson is going to be giving us the view from the ground in Northern Ireland after this break. Newton, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Just before the break there, Dennis Daunton was telling us about that slight change of position, maybe not so slight really, by the British government over the importance or lack of or relevance of the European Court of Justice to the current negotiations over the Northern Ireland Protocol. You've been writing at some length in recent weeks about the positioning or manoeuvring by the DUP in particular in relation to where it stands and under the Donaldson leadership. Geoffrey Donaldson came out again this week and said that the idea of the DUP withdrawing from the institutions in Northern Ireland wasn't out of the question. What do you make of that happening and it happening this week?
Well, the fundamental thing you've got to realise about Geoffrey Donaldson's positioning is he's a mouse dodging under the feet of two elephants, really. He just has to take whatever the UK and EU decide. And so his positioning is to try and spin that with the various factions inside his party and the unionist electorate. And the fact that he's still repeating this threat to bring down Stormont, which nobody now believes indicates that he's in a pretty desperate position. Not only does nobody believe he'd bring down Stormont, but he's out of time for it even to be plausible. There's a scheduled election at the beginning of May. So if you know, if you brought down the Assembly now, that would only be about 3 months before it's due to rise anyway for the election campaign. So what? And also, of course, we've legislation in force now, which means that the Secretary of State can maintain the institutions until the scheduled election. That's legislation that the DUP sought during the last collapse, which Sinn Féin caused. So he just looked ridiculous at about three different levels if he did it. Nobody's taking it seriously. It's a farce. He's completely out of ammunition. So the DUP is done on this. They're just a passenger, a spectator, and that's the only way to look at what they're doing.
If, though, the talks were to go, maybe go well is maybe pushing it, but maybe, you know, to be productive and some of the, you know, the real issues that, that, you know, that arise at the moment in terms of the movement of goods between Northern Ireland and Britain, is there a possible win there at all for the DUP in advance of those elections in May?
He has to. The DUP has to sell whatever happens as a win. It has no option. And so it will just take what the UK gets and rose it in glitter. That basically will be what it will have to do. And of course, there are wins here. We're going to end up with a better protocol, that is a more mitigated protocol than the one the DUP was saying was a gateway to opportunity just 12 months ago, less than 12 months ago. So there will be enough there, I think, for Donaldson to have a go at selling this. But again, everybody now in unionism and loyalism is wise to what he's up to. It's just going to be, he's just going to be laughed at. I think that his real salvation comes from the fact that the majority of the unionist community is reluctantly, grudgingly accepting of what's happening. And so they will, I think, go along with it. But that, of course, doesn't include a huge chunk of the DUP's vote. They'll be furious.
And so, therefore, there's still a threat from the right, from the traditional unionist voice and Jim Allister at these elections.
I think that's vastly overstated, especially by polls. The TUV is a one-man protest party. It's going to struggle to get a second Assembly member, let alone the 5 to 10 its polling results predicted. And everyone knows that. And I think that in the ballot box or in the polling booth, voters will recognise that, or their votes will transfer in effect anyway. So I think that's largely overstated. It's a bit of a protest vote, a protest even answer to pollsters, I think, at the minute. But what will really damage the DUP is simply people staying at home, not voting for it. That's where parties are damaged, not really by voters moving, but by voters just giving up on them. And of course, nobody sits at home like a fed up unionist.
Is one way to get those fed up unionists out is to dangle the prospect. In fact, it's more of a prospect. It's the extreme probability of a Sinn Féin first minister, which, as we know, is purely, you know, it's not ceremonial, but it's symbolic if it's anything at all. It's not even particularly symbolic if for anybody who actually knows the rules of the game, of the Belfast Agreement. But is that a way of scaring the voters out of their comfort and out of the polling booths?
It is, and it has been in the past. However, it doesn't seem to have the traction it used to. The fact that several polls in series showed the unionist vote splitting three ways indicated that scare didn't initially work. If unionist voters were motivated to have the largest party, why would they be heading off in three or indeed four different directions if you count alliance and consistently doing that? So it's a scare tactic that's lost its grip. It will still, I think, come back into play. And if the DUP can manage to poll quite close to Sinn Féin, if its numbers get back within a realistic range of beating Sinn Féin, then I think you might see more voters thinking, oh, well, sure, we might as well give them a vote and get the First Minister's post. Ironically or perversely, when the DUP was 10 points behind Sinn Féin, it was less likely to pick up, I think, on that solidarity vote, because most unionists would have thought, well, what's the point? They're not going to beat Sinn Féin anyway.
And so it has this very difficult position, it seems to me, that it's, you know, there is competition on the right to some extent from the TUV. There's competition on the more moderate unionist liberal side from a somewhat renewed Ulster Unionist Party, and plus an alliance party as well, which appeals to some unionist voters. So it's got to look at about three or four directions at the same time. And then you add to that this perhaps loss of prestige or respect, which you describe in terms of the Donaldson leadership, and indeed all the shenanigans that went on around leadership for the last year or so. Are you saying really it's only saving grace is going to be it'll remain the largest unionist party, and those are the people will gravitate back towards it in the weeks before the election? Is that it, basically?
Yes, I think that the UUP's recovery, I think, is probably a little bit overstated. It's very largely an insider phenomenon. I think Doug Beattie spends far too much time online, in my opinion. I know that's the thing to do. And certainly you can extend that criticism to Naomi Long as well. It seems to work for her, though. But I mean, Beattie also, he does get out and about. He has been meeting people everywhere. There's no doubt about that, too. But I mean, I'm not convinced there's going to be this massive Beattie bounce. I just don't see it yet. And the polls are divided and confused on it as well. Some show the UUP surging ahead. Some show the Alliance surge still in full swing. And those are both dependent very largely on unionist, floating unionist voters.
Sure. And then on the other side of the equation, as I said, the likelihood is that Michelle O'Neill will be first minister after the next election. I mean, we can't rule out surprises, but that certainly looks like the most likely thing. And having said what I said about it not being particularly relevant to the day-to-day operation of the machinery of government in Belfast, I have no doubt that it will be marked and noted in some quarters as part of an inexorable political and demographic change on the island of Ireland and in Northern Ireland in particular. And if, as seems very very likely, Sinn Féin enter government in the Republic at some point in the next three and a half years or whenever the next general election falls, that will further be seen as part of the same incremental change. As you probably know, we ran a poll in the Irish Times at the weekend about views in the Republic towards unity. There were some quite interesting numbers in that, I thought. I was looking at a poll which was just published by the Tory peer Lord Ashcroft, who's in the habit of commissioning polls, on views in Northern Ireland on Irish unity. What did you make of those numbers?
Well, you can compare them directly to his last poll in 2019, which was the only poll ever to show unionism falling behind nationalism, actually on a border poll vote, 46% to 45%. And now unionism is back in a majority if a poll was called today. And confidence that unionism would win a poll has risen. Now it's 51% of people think that in Northern Ireland in this poll think that if a border poll was held within 10 years, unionism would lose it. But that again is a better figure for unionism than Lord Ashcroft found 2 years ago. So actually the headline result on this poll is unionism bouncing back a bit after I think the initial shock of Brexit has worn off. And bear in mind, that's for the only pollster that's ever found anything like strong support for United Ireland, using, I think, the same online panel as used by the other main pollster here. So there's not very much variety in this poll. His analysis of it is rather idiosyncratic. And I think that if you can just look at the trends there, I think you see something that Queen's University research has picked up as well, actually, which is that Brexit has caused a rise in support for unionism. This is part of the polarization of Brexit's effects. We know that it has caused a rise in support for nationalism. It's also caused a rise in support for unionism. That has hollowed out the centre ground. There are now fewer people describing themselves as unaligned. The fact that more of them are voting Alliance, that you've got more of an Alliance and Green vote, that's polarisation as well. There are fewer centrists, but they're angrier. So they're turning up to vote for Alliance. Northern Ireland is the only place where you can have polarisation in three polls. And so that, I think, would be my reading of what we can make from Lord Ashcroft.
Oh my God, I'm not sure what to make of that three-way polarisation. I mean, you have written about the increased volume of the debate around the subject of Irish unity and how that, you think, is playing and will play over the next few years in Northern Ireland. And you have some interesting views on that. You think that things may work differently than the way a lot of people do?
Well, the first thing to remember is that we've all heard this all our lives. A united Ireland is inevitable and 10 years away. So it's not the horribly divisive shock to the unionist psyche that some hope or fear. When you look at the numbers, there is no voting majority for a united Ireland in Northern Ireland. And that's all that counts. It doesn't matter who's first minister, who's in government in Dublin. in theory. Now, of course, if Sinn Féin is heading government in both places, they're going to campaign for a border poll. And Mary Lou McDonald has said that campaign will involve lobbying Washington and Brussels to pressurise London to call a poll. That's outside the terms of the agreement mechanism for a poll. It could be considered to be foreign impediment, external impediment against an actual breach of the Good Friday Agreement. But Sinn Féin doesn't care, of course. It's all about maintaining that idea of momentum and of creating the siege mentality that unionists are criticised for. The message from Republicans is, we've got you surrounded and outnumbered. What's this siege mentality about? And that's going to be the campaign going forward. We've got the whole world against you. Give up, you've lost. And, that doesn't really work. I mean, it's the background noise of unionist life. So that's why you find, I think, unionists surprisingly relaxed, actually, about what should be an Armageddon scenario for them. And we'll certainly be betrayed that way outside Ireland. In the rest of the world, Sinn Féin in office on both sides of the border is going to be seen as the end of the line. And so there'll be some perplexity when it turns out that that isn't the case. My main concern about the next decade or so is that this is going to cause frustration within nationalism about the Good Friday Agreement, because the Good Friday Agreement effectively gives the unionist majority, or plurality as it is in Northern Ireland, a veto over everyone else. That's its fundamental mechanism. And how long is everyone else going to put up with that? You know, I worry about that with the background noise that's going to be turned up. It's just an electoral campaign strategy for Sinn Féin. Of course, Sinn Féin does believe in a united Ireland, but they know as well as everyone else that they're not going to get it this way.
Might it at all be worth it for the unionist parties to think strategically that it might be good to have a referendum sooner rather than later, when they're pretty confident that they could win, and perhaps more importantly than just winning, win by a substantial enough margin to take the prospect of another referendum off the table for a substantial period of time?
Well, when Sinn Féin first began seriously campaigning for a referendum, which I think was in 2013, Arlene Foster, of all people, then a minister, said, bring it on. I think those were her exact words, bring it on and see where it gets you. But, as the flag protest proceeded and things fell apart for unionist politics, that sort of cockiness fell silent. You've rarely heard that suggestion anymore. Peter Robinson has proposed in 2018 generational settlements between border poles. Now, the Good Friday Agreement requires a minimum of 7 years, but I think his idea is, reach 20-year settlements to give us a bit of peace in between them. How could you specify that? How could you say a border poll produced a 51% result for the union? How could you then turn around and say, oh, we're going to wait 20 years now? That wouldn't work. I think in practice, results will be set, the period between border polls will be set by the results. And so there's no real advantage in unionism hastening this process.
Well, let me turn that question around a bit. Is there any danger at all of Republicans being like the dog who caught the car and having a referendum before they have any prospect either of winning it or even getting a result that makes it possible for them to continue arguing for it for a second referendum quite quickly afterwards?
Oh, nothing will ever stop Republicans taking advantage of whatever happens. I see at the minute people in the border poll campaign simultaneously complaining that London won't call a poll and that it might call a poll at any minute for selfish reasons. There's no winning with these people. So why bother, really? That would be, I think, the general union's view. Leave them to it. How could you possibly object to anyone else having a debate or a conversation? They're fully entitled to do so. But we're not going to have anything to do with it.
In relation to a debate or a conversation, one of the things that's already happening and that I suspect is going to happen more and more is a series of what you might broadly describe as civil society initiatives, forums for debate, research projects. I'd say possibly at some point in the future, depending on who's in government in Dublin, maybe some kind of a People's Assembly or a Constitutional Assembly to look at some of the questions around what some people call a shared Ireland, what some people call a united Ireland. I know those two things are quite different. There's a broad expectation that the unionist parties and unionism in general will be reluctant to participate in those, which personally I think would be a shame. But some of the results of the Irish Times poll say to me that that's a project that nationalist Ireland should kind of get about anyway, because it seems to me that a lot of things haven't been properly thrashed out, a lot of really important things. And we only have to look at the example of Brexit to see what happens when nobody thinks about what comes afterwards properly.
Well, first things first, unionism isn't going to assist in negotiating its own demise. And I think that the most sensible nationalists and Republicans accept that as a valid argument. You know, the invitation is there. That's very nice. Thank you, but no, I think would be the general response to that. And if the argument that comes back you occasionally hear is negotiate now while you're still in a position of strength, well, I think, you know, what are we being threatened with if we don't? You know, isn't this United Ireland supposed to be one of rights and equality for all? Not, you know, get your argument in now or it'll make it worse for you. You know, that's not a particularly appealing prospect either.
But is it even a question of negotiation in some of these forums anyway? Like I know, for example, that the system of assemblies here, that's not a negotiation as such. It's more of a series of presentations of papers. Things are taken on board, etc. It's not a question of being forced to come in, you know, and fight for your rights.
All the calls for the as you refer to civil society groups. In fact, it's just basically one campaign for a citizens' assembly. Are not proper citizens' assembly proposal because it's about discussing and planning for a united Ireland. A proper citizens' assembly in that form of consultation requires putting all the options on the table, and then working through them. So you know, you're not going to get that anyway. So I think this is, I mean, it's, you know, it's not a proper citizens' assembly process.
But if you had a citizen, just for the sake of argument, because I have my own reservations about this too. But if you had a citizens' assembly which was on, you know, which was framed as being a debate upon the future constitutional structures on the island of Ireland, mm-hmm. would that be equally unacceptable or not worth engaging with?
I don't think so. I think that there, you do see unionists and even loyalists saying that they might engage with something like that if, for example, it discussed the possibility of the Republic re-entering the UK. But that's so blatantly off the wall that it wouldn't be a credible balancing proposal. It comes down to the much, much wider problem of how do you achieve balance in these issues? The conversation that nationalism is effectively having with itself at the minute about flags and anthems and Commonwealth membership and so on, that's a desperate search for balance. It's very, you know, very honourable in a lot of ways. It is nationalists sitting around thinking, what in the name of God could we give these people that they might like? Maybe a new flag, maybe a new anthem. Bear in mind, unionists aren't asking for these things or engaging at all. Commonwealth membership is something cooked up, I think, entirely from within Dublin. Even the idea that a United Ireland vote might require more than 50% plus one vote was something that came entirely from within nationalism, north and south, from the Taoiseach, from the SDLP, from people like that. Unionists have never suggested this, quite the opposite. And yet unionists ended up getting blamed for it. It ended up becoming an argument about how awful unionists were for wanting to trash the agreement. And I can see that happening in the conversation happening now about flags and anthems. Nationalists start it, engage in it, have a disagreement over it, and at the end decide, God, those awful unionists, they made us have this argument. And it's just a ridiculous spectacle to watch. Why anyone would want to get involved in it, I can't imagine.
And yet, reading your own piece in the Irish Times last week, I mean, I think I'm right in saying that you acknowledge that there is a very strong possibility that there will be a majority for a united Ireland within, I think you suggest, a 50-year time span, which is, you know, which means there are people listening to this podcast who are adults who will still be alive when it's really quite possible, if not probable, that will have come to pass. Does unionism not need to think about what that means and how we get from here to there, or does it just pull up the barricades and say no surrender?
Well, I mean, I think that second option is perfectly valid. I had one reader contacted me online to say, well, if there's going to be United Ireland in 50 years, why not move to it now? And I thought, well, I'll be dead in 50 years. You know, I'm not going to kill myself now. You know, I don't think people quite grasp the mentality of where unionism is on this. What we have, we hold, works in the temporal as well as the physical space. And 50 years from now, the world could be completely different. I mean, 50 years from now, 50 years ago, unionists all considered themselves Irish and wouldn't have had any, the vast majority of unionist people would have had no issue being described as Irish. That's one extraordinary change that has taken place over 50 years, entirely due to the Troubles, as far as I can see. That could reverse again completely in 50 years. Lord knows where we'll be in 50 years. So it is perfectly valid, I think, to just sit tight for the moment and think, well, we'll see how things work out.
And a last question then, and I've put this to a number of other distinguished guests over the last while. What happens if it is a 50% plus one majority in for unity in 10 years or 15 years or whatever? In your view, do unionists then go, fair enough, that's it, story's over? I'm not going to quite say you come out with your hands up, because that would feed into some of the stereotypes, but they basically just say, that's it, those are the rules, and we lost.
Well, to the best of my knowledge, no unionist has ever disagreed with that, no unionist leader. And in fact, I think both Peter Robinson, the Orange Order, and several loyalist leaders that I'm aware of have all said in recent years that a 50% plus one vote would have to be accepted. That's the point. It has to be accepted. It doesn't matter whether anyone would like it or not. How would Northern Ireland be viable otherwise? So yes.
Would those elements of the unionist political movement, which have been associated with violence in the past, do you not think that some of them at least would seek to resist it by force?
The basis for loyalist violence in Northern Ireland has always been the greater number, the majority. That was the basis of it. Without that, I think that sustaining even their idea of any legitimacy for violence would be impossible.
Even if it's the greater number in Antrim,
I think that underestimates the fact that Northern Ireland is real to us. It is our country, and we now perceive of it as our national and geographic unit. And of course, you're saying that has changed, and 100 years ago, but there was a basis of Ulster, of retreating into Ulster itself, a geographical unit. I mean, repartition was something considered by loyalists on the fringes in the 70s, and even they dismissed it as insanity. No, I can't see that happening. I'm not saying that in such a scenario things would be easy, but unionism has already accepted that result would have to be recognised.
It's very, very last question. I promise this is definitely the last question. With all those things going on, and they are undoubtedly going to continue to go on the nationalist side, those sort of debates and that heightening, I suppose, of debate, which you've described, how stand the rather rickety Good Friday Agreement institutions, do you think, in the medium term, like beyond that May election for the following term, and indeed over the next 10 years, given their fairly unimpressive performance over the last 10?
They're absolutely as rock solid as they've ever been, if not even a little bit more so. In fact, one of the weird disconnects about politics at the minute is is how businesslike things are up on the Hill. I've never known it actually to be so busy legislatively. Everyone's in a rush to get serious work done. Sinn Féin's just passed a draft budget, for goodness sake, that actually calls for cuts across the board for health. It's amazing and unprecedented. And yet out amid the chattering classes, such as Northern Ireland has, it's all doom and gloom, and oh, if it falls, it'll never get up again. Whereas in fact, under new legislation, if we had an executive collapse, we'd have an election, and then we'd have another election until it goes back again, and we'd have another land surge, because devolution is what the public wants. It's the only idea Britain and Ireland have ever had for addressing our problem, and it will continue to be so until Northern Ireland's dying day.
On that rather cheerful note, we will leave it there. Thanks very much, Newton, for joining us. Thanks also to Dennis Staunton for joining us, also to our producer, Declan Conlon, and our engineer, JJ Vernon. We're going to be back in your feed very soon indeed. But until then, thanks very much for listening. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.